You're listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Heartland Politics show and podcast, which is aired on and distributed by WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR. WVIK is the flagship public radio station in the Quad Cities region of eastern Iowa and northwestern Illinois. I'm your host, Robin Johnson, and, you know, it's a real honor to have the eminent historian H.W. Brands on, but it's really extraordinary for me to have him on twice in the same year. I had him on earlier to talk about a recent book on Roosevelt and Charles Lindbergh. This time we're going to talk about his biography of Andrew Jackson. That book was written 20 years ago, but it's still got a lot of application to what's going on today. And Professor Brand, I'm so grateful for you to taking the time to be on again.
Happy to do it. Thank you for inviting me back.
Well, before we get to some of the parallels with today and some of the lessons for today, I think it's important to start, and for our listeners who took history classes a long time ago, maybe, and remember some of Andrew Jackson, I really think this is a guy whose upbringing shaped his personality and that edge, I guess we can politely say, that he had throughout his life. But talk a little bit about his upbringing and how that affected him later.
So Andrew Jackson was an enormously popular figure during his day, in large part because he was the first very ordinary person to become president of the United States. From George Washington through John Quincy Adams, who was Jackson's predecessor, the people who became president were either wealthy, well-connected, or well-educated. These were the aristocracy, some of them aristocracy by wealth, some by education. The two Adamses, for example, they weren't rich, but they were very well-educated. And so The presidency was not the office of the people until Jackson made it that way. And Jackson's story was, boy, it was not exactly rags to riches, but it was hard times to riches. Yeah. Jackson's father died before he was born. So he was raised by his mother, and his mother didn't have any money. The family was poor to begin with, and the mother was mostly a governess for rich folks' kids. And she had her two kids along. She sort of dragged them along. So they always grew up knowing that they were part of the lower class, where the rich folks that they were in are the upper class kids. So Jackson developed this idea that everything that he was going to gain in life, he would have to grab and he would have to hold. And it would come by dint of hard effort, by determination, by sheer stubbornness in some cases. So his mother died, actually, when he was a young teenager, and the consequences there really shaped him. Because at the age of 13, he participated in the Revolutionary War. Now, he was too young, actually, to carry arms, but he was a courier. He was always a good horse rider, and he was a little guy, and he could ride horses like crazy, and he carried messages between the Patriot, the rebel forces, in the border region between North Carolina and South Carolina. Now, this was an area that was beset by fighting, not so much between the British and the Americans, but between Americans and Americans. It's important to remember for this that the American Revolutionary War was as much a civil war as it was a war between the British and the Americans. And so Jackson got caught in the middle of this. In fact, he did get caught. He was taken prisoner, and he was in a prisoner of war camp. And the story goes, and this is one that Jackson told, and it meant a lot to him, that while he was a prisoner of war camp, in a prisoner of war, the British commander of the camp came in after one hard day riding out and getting his boots all muddy, and took the muddy boots to Jackson here, say, "Here, boy, you know, clean my boots." And Jackson didn't like being ordered around by anybody. And his response was, in effect, "Kiss mine." And then what happened is that the soldier, he was a cavalry officer, pulled out his saber and took a swipe at Jackson's head. And Jackson threw up his hand, and his hand warded off most of the blow, but not all of it. And the edge of the blade caught Jackson in the scalp and in the skull. And of course, any scalp wounds, they bleed like crazy. So he looked like a stuck pig, but ever afterwards, he had a scar there, and he had this dent in his skull. And whenever he would get angry, his his hand would just sort of unconsciously go up there and rub that point. And he would be reminded of how much he hated the British. Now, this became a theme with Jackson. And I'll fast forward a little bit because Jackson would then become a national hero by defeating the British at the Battle of New Orleans in early 1815. And that this is what made Jackson such a hero, because the War of 1812 had started optimistically for Americans. Americans thought, boy, we'll conquer Canada, we'll slap the British around. It didn't turn out that way at all. In fact, it was a near disaster for the United States. And this culminated in a British invasion of Washington, D.C., the capital, and the major government buildings were burned, the White House, the Capitol, the Treasury building, and so on. And so it looked like it was going to be a disaster. But then at the last minute, Jackson wins with a surprising victory, defeats the British at the Battle of New Orleans. And so Americans, the one thing they take away from this otherwise unsatisfactory war is that Jackson's his hero and Jackson saved America from the British. And so Jackson became his generation's version of George Washington. But with this twist, George Washington was not a man of the people by any means. Andrew Jackson was, and his timing was perfect because by Jackson's day, the old aristocratic mode of politics had given way to the culture of democracy. There were a variety of reasons for this, but Jackson was the perfect person to take advantage of this and to embody this because democracy emerged in the American West, in part because the West, the frontier settlements, were always more egalitarian than the entrenched societies of the East. And so Jackson was the first man of the West to become president. And so he rode into the presidency. It took him two times. He ran in 1824. And although he got more of the popular vote than any other candidate, he didn't get a majority, and he didn't get a majority of the electoral vote. So the race went to the House of Representatives. And under the rules then, the House gets to decide among the top three finishers. And the House decided against Jackson in favor of John Quincy Adams. And there was nothing corrupt about this. It's just the way politics goes. But Jackson, and especially his followers, looked upon this as the election that had been stolen from them. Now, they didn't go out in the street, they didn't take arms against it, but they did start campaigning immediately for the following election. And the election of 1828 was down and dirty, and there was all sorts of slander thrown this way and that against all the candidates. And Jackson won this time. He won convincingly. But there was a dark shadow over his election because his wife, Rachel, was treated so badly in the politics of the campaign that she had a mental breakdown. And then she had a physical breakdown and she died before Jackson, between Jackson's election and the time he could get inaugurated. And Jackson was so distraught. He was deeply attached to Rachel. And he sort of thought, gosh, after losing Rachel, I'm not even sure I can go to Washington. But his supporters said, well, no, you need to go to Washington. You need to get back at those people who killed your Rachel. So off he goes to Washington. And when he's inaugurated in early 1829, the staid old guard of Washington, they think that the barbarians have taken over the place because 10,000 of Jackson's followers have said, hey, now's a good time to go to Washington. And they show up. They don't have a place to stay, so they're camping around the city, and they're just, they are rough and ready types.
The
And
famous story about him in the White House and kind of
oh,
knocking things
well,
around
yeah.
and
So after the inauguration, in those days, instead of having an inaugural ball, they had an inaugural levee, they call it. It was a reception, and Jackson's reception was the first one was thrown open to just the ordinary people before you had to have connections with Jackson. All these out-of-towners, they come and they basically storm the White House. And there's so many of them, and they're so enthusiastic about Jackson, and they get so drunk that they tear the place apart. It costs thousands of dollars to repair the damage. Jackson himself was nearly crushed to death. He had to escape out the back door. So, anyway, so this is Jackson. This is Jackson becoming president in early 1829. And Jackson's ascent to the presidency is seen as sort of the beginning and the confirmation of the age of democracy in American politics. Because before this, as I said, you could be aristocratic. You could almost say you're better than other people and become president of the United States. But after Jackson, from Jackson forward, you don't get away with saying that. Now, you can be rich, you can be well educated, but you have to act as though you have a common touch. You have to say you're fighting for the common man of America, even if you're very uncommon. But that really changed the culture of American, changed the culture of American politics.
I was going to ask, because the John Adams, Thomas Jefferson races were very robust. Those are about the only ones, really, other than when you until you get up to Jackson, it seems like. But what's the difference between those and the Jacksonian era as far as what you describe as the beginning of our true democracy here?
Well, one of the biggest things is that from George Washington through James Monroe, who was the one before John Quincy Adams, in most cases, the electors, now we all know we have an electoral college, so the president is not directly elected by the voters. The electors, they choose the electors. But before Jackson's day, the electors themselves were not even chosen by the voters. They were chosen by the state legislatures. And so in no sense before Jackson's day was the presidency the office of the people. But in Jackson's day, by Jackson's time, nearly all of the electors were chosen by a popular vote in the states. And so, and it's worth noting, it's worth remembering that in the American federal system, the only office that people, everybody around the country gets to vote for is the presidency. I mean, we'll include the vice presidency with it, but you get what I mean. So we choose, of course, governors state by state. We choose senators state by state. So if I'm in Texas and you're in Alaska, we don't vote for the same candidates. We vote for members of the House of Representatives by congressional district. The only office that really unites all Americans, it's the only race that everybody in the country can participate in, is the presidency. And in Jackson's day, by Jackson's day, it had become one where people around the country could say, I'm voting for Jackson, or I'm voting for John Quincy Adams, or whoever it is. So it really becomes the focus of American political energy in a way that it had not before.
You're listening to Heartland Politics on WVIK, Quad Cities NPR. This is your host, Robin Johnson, and I'm very honored to have as my guest the eminent historian, H.W. Brands, who we're talking about one of his more than 30 books. It's called Andrew Jackson, His Life and Times. What book am I reading in yours next? I think the one on the late 1800s, but I've made a point to start reading more of your books. I don't know if I'll get all 30 plus, but this story of Andrew Jackson is just fascinating, and it still has applications today. I pulled something out because right now we're going through this political realignment of more class-based politics. And you've got a quote of Jackson saying, "The poor always make the best soldiers." And your comment was a republic, interpreting that, a republic that relied on the poor would survive, one that depended on the rich, perhaps not. That's how he governed as well, especially in the battle with the National Bank, which has parallels to today about whether the president follows Supreme Court decisions.
Yeah. So in Jackson's day, America was trying to figure out how to run its money supplies, monetary policy. And it was, there are various ways you can do it. You could have Congress say how many dollars there will be out there, how much money to print. You can also have, you can leave it to private banks. In Jackson's day, it was left to a private bank, but a national bank. It was a bank that was chartered nationally. The federal government had some influence in it. It was a precursor to the modern Federal Reserve. It was called the Bank of the United States. Strictly speaking, Jackson's time, it was the second version of the Bank of the United States. Now, it had been originally proposed in the 1790s by Alexander Hamilton, who himself was a banker, a friend of bankers, a friend of the rich. And Hamilton wanted to create a bank, the National Bank, the Bank of the United States, in order to ally the interests of the wealthy folks, the creditor class, with the government. And he wanted a national debt, for example. And so people who had money would invest it in the government, and therefore they would have a stake in the success of the government. The first bank of the United States, it had a 20-year charter. It expired and was allowed to lapse, but then it was revived. And it became an issue during Jackson's day because, well, Jackson was elected on what amounted to a populist platform. Jackson ran as the opponent of the rich, the entrenched, the privileged classes who had been running the country since George Washington. And Jackson thought it's time for ordinary people to take control of the country. Now, Jackson, like very many Americans, was skeptical, indeed suspicious of banks in general. Banking is, if you think about it, it's still a very weird business in the sense that, well, particularly in Jackson's day, every town had a bank, and typically the bank was the wealthiest person in town. But the banker never seemed to be doing any work. The banker showed up late, left early, didn't break a sweat when everybody else is a blacksmith or a farmer or teamster or something like that. So how does he do it? And the conclusion was, well, somehow they're ripping off poor folks. I mean, that's not true, but that was the impression that came out. And especially for people in the West who felt underbanked, the money supply was always slim in the West. And so it seemed to them as though, I mean, basically the West was running a balance of payments deficit with the East, and the money was all clearing out to the East. So it was a popular thing to do in the West to be against the National Bank. And Jackson was against the National Bank. But he was not going to take it on head on. He was going to let it had a 20-year charter, it was going to expire. He would have let it expire. But his principal political foe, Henry Clay, decided that he was going to raise the issue in order to use it against Jackson when Jackson was running for re-election in 1832. And so Henry Clay made a big issue of it. Jackson says, fine, you're going to make an issue of it. So what Clay did was he persuaded Congress to recharter the bank ahead of time, actually, and dared Jackson to veto the charter of the bank. He thought that Jackson could not do this because it would so upset the equilibrium of the financial system that, well, he just wouldn't risk it. Well, Clay didn't know Jackson as well as he thought, because Jackson was not a person you'd dare to do anything, especially if he thinks it's the right thing to do. So Jackson took on the bank. He made it an issue in the 1832 election, and he won handsomely. So he's got this charter. I mean, he's got this mandate that says, okay, you defeated the bank. Jackson thereupon proceeded to essentially dismantle the bank. In doing so, he prompted the director of the bank, a guy named Nicholas Biddle, to demonstrate how important the bank was. And basically, Biddle takes the position that, to put it in modern terminology, the Bank of the United States should have been too big to fail. But Jackson said, it's going to fail. I'm going to kill the bank. And so Nicholas Biddle, in effect, engineers a financial panic to show Jackson, to show the country, you need us, you can't do without us. But Jackson interpreted as, well, this shows how utterly irresponsible and dangerous you actually are. Nobody should have that kind of control over America's financial system. So what came to be called the Bank War ended in, well, I'll call it a victory for Jackson, a victory for Jackson's side. And the Bank of the United States just faded into oblivion. But the money's got to go somewhere. So the money went to state banks. They were sometimes called pet banks because these banks were the favorites of a lot of the people who voted for Jackson, in part because they thought, well, we can make money off the banking instead of letting all the business go to the National Bank. The state banks, well, the experience of the state banks demonstrated why the country needed a national bank. Because they lent money like crazy. There was a big inflationary boom, especially a real estate boom, to the point where Jackson himself felt obliged to put a damper on it. And he said basically that no longer would borrowed money be, or paper money be, allowed in the purchase of federal land. In those days, the federal government was in the business of selling a lot of public land. And when that happened, the price of land collapsed and there was this financial panic. The first full-blown financial panic in American history, the Panic of 1837. Now, Jackson was by this time just out of office. And so the stuff that he set in motion led to this financial panic. And the upshot of it is, this is my conclusion about this. Jackson's victory over Nicholas Biddle in the so-called Bank War was a triumph for American democracy, but it was a disaster for American prosperity because it produced this financial panic. And one of the things that it, well, it sort of did was to cure the populace in America of thinking that they ought to control the money supply. It took a long time for this view to set in, but and there were repeated financial panics through the 19th century until finally the country managed to produce the Federal Reserve System. Now, the Federal Reserve today is as tempting a target for today's populace as the National Bank was in Jackson's day. But it would be as foolish and as counterproductive for the government to do away with the Federal Reserve or to diminish its independence today as it was in Jackson's day. Because what happens is if you make the money supply and monetary policy a function of politics, well, the politicians cannot resist the temptation to basically rev up the economy to make things go well just before the election so they can say everybody's got a job, everybody's prosperous. But you build in this inflationary tendency in the economy. And so sooner or later, it's going to come back and bite you. You're going to build up these bubbles. And it was something that took America a century to learn. Now, it's taken us about a century to unlearn it. We'll see if it actually gets unlearned or not.
As everybody, well, as most people are aware, when President Trump was elected, he had a big portrait, supposedly, of Andrew Jackson up in the White House. He's changed that now in his second term with now William McKinley, because of tariffs, is his big, maybe perhaps favorite president. But the parallels still between Trump and Jackson are there. Talk a little bit about maybe the similarities, differences between them as their individual characteristics, but also their movements, the Jacksonian populist movement, the Trump populist movement.
Yeah, so what you say there about the movements, I think the parallel there is much closer than the parallel between Jackson as an individual and Donald Trump as an individual. Because Donald Trump was born rich and he hobnobbed, you know, with the wealthy and stuff that Jackson never did. Jackson believed that his word was his bond. If he said he was going to do something, he did something. Jackson absolutely revered women, starting with his wife. And so Jackson was a very different individual than Donald Trump. But the people who voted for Donald Trump were very much in the same line of thinking as the people who voted for Andrew Jackson. In both cases, there was this broad feeling that the folks who run the government, the establishment, is out of touch with the people. And we're going to send a message to you. We're going to elect this outsider that you don't like, somebody that you tell us is a wild man who's going to destroy everything about America. Well, that's exactly what the elites were saying about Jackson in the 1820s. That's what the elites were saying about Donald Trump in the 2010s. So the parallel is there. And it's, of course, you know, tempting for a president, President Trump, to cast himself as the next Jackson. Except, as you point out, that worked better in the first term than the second term, where the second term is based on tariffs. And tariffs were the thing that almost destroyed the country in Jackson's presidency. And to the point where Jackson had to threaten South Carolina, which was trying to secede over the issue of tariffs. He had to threaten to wage war against South Carolina. And so that it steadied the minds of the people and brought the country back together. So the parallel, I would say the parallel is between the Jackson moment and the Trump moment, more than between Jackson as an individual and Trump as an individual.
Was there something, you know, we all, I mean, the reason I still love reading history is I still get surprised by new facts or new interpretations or whatever that, you know, you go through your grade school, middle school, high school education, even college. But reading books like this provides so much more depth. Was there anything that surprised you about Andrew Jackson and his presidency that maybe you didn't appreciate much before?
I won't say it surprised me, but I'll tell you something that had long puzzled me. And the thing that had puzzled me was why Jackson was so popular during his day, and why Jackson became very unpopular among most of the American public by, let's say, the late 20th century. I talked to elementary and secondary school teachers a lot, So I do teacher workshops. And to gauge what their students know, I ask them, for example, with Andrew Jackson, what do your students know about Andrew Jackson? And for the last 40 years, the answer I get consistently comes in three words: Trail of Tears. This is what modern Americans know about Andrew Jackson, that he was the president who insisted that Indians leave the eastern half of the United States and go out to the west. And that's part of the story. But that doesn't explain why Jackson was so popular. Jackson was the most popular American between George Washington and Franklin Roosevelt. And much more popular, for example, than Abraham Lincoln or anybody else in the 19th century. And I wondered, so why was it? Why did people in Jackson's day think so much of him? And by the way, one of the ways I measured this was to go to a big atlas that I had and look in the index of the atlas to see how many places in America are named for particular identifiable individuals. And so, how many places are named for Washington? How many places are named for Franklin? How many places are named for Jackson? It turns out there are more places named for Jackson than for Washington or Franklin. And those three are
Interesting.
far ahead of anybody else. So, what was it that caused people to name stuff after Andrew Jackson? And it was the fact, first of all, that we've talked about, he was the first people's president, the first president to represent the American people in a way the presidents hadn't. So that's the first thing. The second thing is he beat the British. And by beating the British, he really confirmed George Washington's victory in the Revolutionary War. He sort of confirmed it the second time around. And it was a bigger deal then than now because the Battle of New Orleans wasn't this insignificant thing. If the British had won the Battle of New Orleans, the United States might have been split in two along the line of the Mississippi River. There was that. And the third thing, paradoxically, the thing that's held against Jackson in modern times, his policy toward Indians, was in fact held in favor of Jackson in his day because Jackson opened up the West. And Jackson, to put it even more bluntly, for people in the West, Jackson built his first reputation as an Indian fighter, as someone who protected the Western settlements against Indians. Now, modern Americans, they sort of say, well, what do you mean needed to protect the settlements against the Indians? You know, the settlements shouldn't have been there in the first place. Except nobody's willing to really follow that up and say, well, what's the logic? Where does that go if you say that? Well, basically, nobody should have left Europe to come to America. And so people in Jackson's day were much more realistic about what actually had happened and who made it happen. So I guess the most enduring thing is that Jackson demonstrated that democracy doesn't just happen. You have to culture it, you have to nurture it, you have to protect it. Now, it's easy for Americans in most of the 20th century to suppose that, well, that was going to happen anyway. Well, no, it required people like Jackson and people in Jackson's day. And for three or four generations after Jackson understood that it required Jackson or somebody very much like him to make America the country it became. So Franklin Roosevelt, elected in 1932, his model president was Andrew Jackson.
Those are great comments to leave on. And I want to thank you again for taking the time to be my guest today. Eminent historian H.W. Brands, the author of Andrew Jackson, His Life and Times, which has been our topic today, very relevant to a lot of our current discussions. Professor, thank you so much.
My pleasure, Robin. Take care.
You've been listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson.